discovered that she had not told Blajini about the horrible Mr. Jenkins, not Mr. Jenkins, who had turned into a bird of nothingness, the Mr. Jenkins Louise had resented so fiercely. She should have told Blajini. She would tell him first thing in the morning. Charles Wallace climbed up onto one of the lab stools and perched close to his mother. "What I really need are lessons in adaptation. I've been reading Darwin, but he hasn't helped me much." "See what we mean?" Calvin asked Dr. Louise. "That's hardly what one expects from a 6-year-old. "He really does read Darwin," Meg assured the doctor. "And I still haven't learned how to adapt," Charles Wallace added. Dr. Louise was making a paste of cocoa sugar and a little hot water from one of Mrs. Murray's retorts. "This is just water, isn't it?" she asked. "From our artesian well, the very best water." Dr. Louise added milk little by little. "You kids are too young to remember, and your mother is a good 10 years younger than I am, but I'll never forget a great many years ago when the first astronauts went to the moon and I sat up all night to watch them." "I remember it all right," Mrs. Murray said. "I wasn't that young." Dr. Louise stirred the cocoa, which was heating over a Bunsen burner. "Do you remember those first steps on the moon? So tentative to begin with, on that strange, airless, alien terrain. And then, in a short time, Armstrong and Aldrin were striding about confidently, and the commentator remarked on this as an extraordinary example of man's remarkable ability to adapt." "But all they had to adapt to was the moon's surface," Meg objected. "It wasn't inhabited. I'll bet when our astronauts reach some place with inhabitants, it won't be so easy. It's a lot simpler to adapt to low gravity or no atmosphere or even sandstorms than it is to hostile inhabitants." Fortinbras, who had an uncanine fondness for cocoa, came padding out to the lab, his nose twitching in anticipation. He stood on his hind legs and put his front paws on Charles Wallace's shoulders. Dr. Culebra asked Meg, "Do you think the first graders in the village school are hostile inhabitants, then?" "Of course. Charles isn't like them, and so they're hostile towards him. People are always hostile to anybody who's different." "Until they get used to him," the doctor said. "They're not getting used to Charles." Charles Wallace, fondling the big dog, said, "Don't forget to give Ford a saucer. He likes cocoa." "You have the strangest pets," Dr. Louise said, but she poured a small dish of cocoa for Fortinbras. "I'll let it cool a bit before I put it on the floor. Meg, we need mugs." "Okay." Meg hurried off to the kitchen, collected a stack of mugs, and returned to the laboratory. Dr. Louise lined them up and poured the cocoa. "Speaking of pets, how's my namesake?" Meg nearly spilled the cocoa she was handing to her mother. She looked closely at Dr. Louise. But though the question had seemed pointed, the little bird face showed nothing more than amused interest. As Charles Wallace said, Dr. Louise was very good at talking on one level and thinking on another. Charles Wallace answered the question. "Louise the Larger is a magnificent snake. I wonder if she'd like some cocoa. Snakes like milk, don't they?" Mrs. Murray said firmly, "You are not going back out tonight to find if the snake, magnificent though she be, likes cocoa. Save your experimental zeal for daylight. Louise is undoubtedly sound asleep." Dr. Louise carefully poured out the last of the cocoa into her own mug. "Some snakes are very sociable at night. Many years ago, when I was working in a hospital in the Philippines, I had a boa constrictor for a pet. We had a problem with rats in the ward, and my boa constrictor did a thorough job of keeping the rodent population down. He also liked cream of mushroom soup, though I never tried him on cocoa. And he was a delightful companion in the evenings, affectionate and cuddly." Meg did not think that she would enjoy cuddling with a snake, even Louise. "He also had impeccable judgment about human nature. He was naturally a friendly creature, and if he showed me that he disliked or distrusted somebody, I took him seriously. We had a man brought to the men's ward who seemed to have nothing more seriously wrong with him than a slightly inflamed appendix, but my boa constrictor took a dislike to him the moment he was admitted. That night, he tried to kill the man in the next bed. Fortunately, we got to him in time. But the snake knew. After that, I listened to his warnings immediately." "Fortinbras has the same instinct about people," Mrs. Murray said. "Too bad we human beings have lost it." Meg wanted to say, "So does Louise the Larger," but her mother or the doctor would have asked her on what experience she based such a remark. It would have sounded more likely coming from the twins. Charles Wallace regarded Dr. Culebra, who had returned to the red leather chair and was sipping cocoa, her legs tucked under her like a child. As a matter of fact, she was considerably smaller than Meg. Charles said, "We take Louise very seriously, Dr. Louise. Very seriously." Dr. Louise nodded. Her voice was light and high. "That was what I had in mind." Calvin finished his cocoa. "Thank you very much. I better get on home now. See you in school tomorrow, Meg. Thanks again, Mrs. Murray and Dr. Culebra. Good night." When he had gone, Mrs. Murray said, "All right, Charles. The twins have been in bed for an hour. Meg, it's time for you, too. Charles, I'll come check on you in a few minutes." As they left the lab, Meg could see her mother turning back to the microelectron microscope. Meg undressed slowly, standing by her attic window, wondering if Dr. Louise's talk about snakes had been entirely casual chat over a cup of cocoa. Perhaps it was only the strange events of the evening which caused her to look for meanings under the surface of what might well be unimportant conversation. She turned out the lights and looked out the window. She could see across the vegetable garden to the orchard, but the trees still held enough leaves so that she could not see into the north pasture. Was there really a cherubim waiting at the star-watching rock, curled up into a great feathery ball, all those eyes closed in sleep? Was he real? What is real? Chapter 4. Prognoscus. Meg woke up before dawn, suddenly and completely as though something had jerked her out of sleep. She listened. Only the usual noises of the sleeping house. She turned on the light and looked at her clock. She had set the alarm for 6, as usual. It was now 5. She had another whole hour in which she could curl up under the covers and luxuriate in warmth and comfort and doze. Then she remembered. She tried to reassure herself that she was remembering a dream, although it was not the way that a dream is remembered. It must have been a dream. Obviously, it must have been a dream. The only way to prove that it was nothing but a dream, without waking Charles Wallace and asking him, was to get dressed and go out to the star-watching rock and make sure that there was no cherubim there. And, if by some slim chance it had not been a dream, she had promised the cherubim that she would come to him before breakfast. Had it not been for the horrible moments with Mr. Jenkins screeching across the sky, she would not have wanted it to be a dream. She desperately wanted Blagini to be real, to take care of everything. But the unreality of Mr. Jenkins, who had always been disagreeably predictable, was far more difficult for her to accept than the teacher, or even a cherubim who looked like a drive of dragons. She dressed hurriedly, putting on her kilt and a clean blouse. She tiptoed downstairs as quietly and carefully as she had the night before, through the kitchen and into the pantry, where she put on her heaviest jacket and a multicolored knitted tam-o'-shanter, one of her mother's rare successful ventures into domesticity. This time no wind blew, no doors slammed. She turned on the flashlight to guide her. It was a still, chill pre-dawn. The grass was white with spider-web tracings of dew and light frost. A thin vapor moved delicately across the lawn. The mountains were curtained by ground fog, although in the sky she could see stars. She ran across the garden, looking warily about her. But there was no Mr. Jenkins. Of course there was no Mr. Jenkins. At the stone wall she looked carefully for Louise, but there was no sign of the big snake. She crossed the orchard, climbed the wall again. Still no Louise. It was much too early and much too cold for snakes, anyhow, and ran across the north pasture, past the two glacial rocks and to the star-watching rock. There was nothing there except the mist whirling gently in the faint breeze. So it had all been a dream. Then the mist seemed to solidify, to become moving wings, eyes opening and shutting, tiny flickers of fire, small puffs of misty smoke. You're real, she said loudly. You're not something I dreamed after all. Proganoscus delicately stretched one huge wing skywards, then folded it. I have been told that human beings seldom dream about cherubim. Thank you for being prompt. It is in the nature of cherubim to dislike tardiness. Meg sighed in resignation, in fear, and surprisingly in relief. Okay, Progo, I guess you're not a figment of my imagination. What do we do now? I've got just about an hour before breakfast. Are you hungry? No, I'm much too excited to be hungry. But if I don't turn up on time, it won't go down very well if I explain that I was late because I was talking with a cherubim. My mother doesn't like tardiness either. Proganoscus said, Much can be accomplished in an hour. We have to find out what our first ordeal is. Don't you know? Why would I know? You're a cherubim. Even a cherubim has limits. When three ordeals are planned, then nobody knows ahead of time what they are. Even the teacher may not know. Then what do we do? How do we find out? Proganoscus waved several wings slowly back and forth in thought, which would have felt very pleasant on a hot day, but which on a cold morning made Meg turn up the collar of her jacket. The cherubim did not notice. He continued waving and thinking. Then she could feel his words moving slowly, tentatively within her mind. If you've been assigned to me, I suppose you must be some kind of a namer, too. Even if a primitive one. A what? A namer. For instance, the last time I was with a teacher, or at school, as you call it, my assignment was to memorize the names of the stars. Which stars? All of them. You mean all the stars in all the galaxies? Yes, if he calls for one of them, someone has to know which one he means. Anyhow, they like it. There aren't many who know them all by name, and if your name isn't known, then it's a very lonely feeling. Am I supposed to learn the names of all the stars, too? It was an appalling thought. Good galaxy, no. Then what am I supposed to do? Proganoscus waved several wings, which Meg was learning was more or less his way of expressing. I haven't the faintest idea. Well, then, if I'm a namer, what does that mean? What does a namer do? The wings drew together, the eyes closed singly and in groups until all were shut. Small puffs of mist-like smoke rose, swirled about him. When I was memorizing the names of the stars, part of the purpose was to help them each to be more particularly the particular star each one was supposed to be. That's basically a namer's job. Maybe you're supposed to make Earthlings feel more human. What's that supposed to mean? She sat down on the rock beside him. She was somehow no longer afraid of his wildness, his sighs, his spurts of fire. He asked, How do I make you feel? She hesitated, not wanting to be rude, forgetting that the cherubim, far more than Charles Wallace, did not need her outward words to know what was being said within. But she answered truthfully, Confused. Several puffs of smoke went up. Well, we don't know each other very well yet. Who makes you the least confused? Calvin. There was no hesitation here. When I'm with Calvin, I don't mind being me. You mean he makes you more you, don't you? I guess you could put it that way. Who makes you feel the least you? Mr. Jenkins. Proganoscus probed sharply. Why are you suddenly upset and frightened? He's the principal of the grade school in the village this year. But he was in my school last year, and I was always getting sent to his office. He never understands anything, and everything I do is automatically wrong. Charles Wallace would probably be better off if he weren't my brother. That's enough to finish him with Mr. Jenkins. Is that all? What do you mean? When you say Mr. Jenkins, I feel such a cold wave of terror wash over you that I feel chilly myself. Progo, something happened last night. Before we met, you and Blagini. When I was all alone in the garden, her voice tailed off. What happened, Earthling? Tell me, I have a feeling this may be important. Why should it be difficult to tell Proganoscus? The cherubim himself was just as unbelievable. But the cherubim was himself, was Proganoscus, while Mr. Jenkins had not been Mr. Jenkins. As she tried to explain to Proganoscus, she could sense him pulling away. And suddenly, he flung all his wings about himself in a frantic reflex of self-preservation. Then two eyes looked out at her under one wing. Ekthroi. It was an ugly word. As Proganoscus uttered it, the morning seemed colder. What did you say? Meg asked. You're Mr. Jenkins, the real one. Could he do anything like the one you just told me about? Could he fly into a nothingness in the sky? This is not a thing that human beings can do, is it? No. You say he was like a dark bird, but a bird that was nothingness, and that he tore the sky? Well, that's how I remember it. It was all quick and unexpected, and I was terrified, and I couldn't really believe that it had happened. It sounds like the Ekthroi. He covered his eyes again. The what? Slowly, as though with a great effort, he uncovered several eyes. The Ekthroi. Oh, Earthling, if you do not know Ekthroi. I don't want to, not if they're like what I saw last night. Proganoscus agitated his wings. I think we must go see this, Mr. Jenkins. The one you say is at your little brother's school. Why? Proganoscus withdrew into all his wings again. Meg could feel him thinking grumpily. They told me it was going to be difficult. Why couldn't they have sent me off someplace quiet to recite the stars again? Or I'm even willing to memorize Ferandali. I've never been to Earth before. I'm too young. I'm scared of the shadowed planets. What kind of a star has this planet got, anyhow? Then he emerged slowly, one pair of eyes at a time. Megling, I think you have seen an Ekthros. If we are dealing with Ekthroi, then I just know with every feather on my wings, and you might try counting my feathers sometime, that we have to go see this Mr. Jenkins. It must be part of the trial. Mr. Jenkins? Part of our first test? But that's... it doesn't make sense. It does to me. Progo, she objected, it's impossible. I can slip off my school bus and then walk to the grade school the way I did when I went to talk to Mr. Jenkins about Charles Wallace and a fat lot of good that did. If you have seen an Ekthros, everything is different, Proganoscus said. Okay, I can get to the grade school all right, but I can't possibly take you with me. You're so big you wouldn't even fit into the school bus. Anyhow, you'd terrify everybody. At the thought, she smiled, but Proganoscus was not in a laughing mood. Not everybody is able to see me, he told her. I'm real, and most Earthlings can bear very little reality. But if it will relieve your mind, I'll dematerialize. He waved a few wings gracefully. It's really more comfortable for me not to be burdened with matter, but I thought it would be easier for you if you could converse with someone you could see. The cherubim was there in front of her, covering most of the star-watching rock, and then he was not there. She thought she saw a faint shimmer in the air, but it might have been the approach of dawn. She could feel him, however, moving within her mind. Are you feeling extremely brave, Megling? No. A faint light defined the eastern horizon. The stars were dim, almost extinguished. I think we're going to have to be brave, Earth Child. But it will be easier because we're together. I wonder if the teacher knows. Knows what? That you've seen an Ekthros. Progo, I don't understand. What is an Ekthros? Abruptly, Proganoscus materialized, raised several wings, and gathered her in. Come, Litling. I'll take you someplace yesterday and show you. How can you take me yesterday? I can't possibly take you today, silly. It's time for you to go into breakfast, and your mother dislikes tardiness. And who knows what we may have to do or where we may have to go before tomorrow. Come. He drew her further into him. She found herself looking directly into one of his eyes, a great amber cat's eye, the dark mandala of the pupil opening, compelling, beckoning. She was drawn towards the oval, was pulled into it, was through it, into the ultimate night on the other side. Then she felt a great flaming wind and knew that somehow she herself was part of that wind. Then she felt a great shove, and she was standing on a bare stone mountaintop, and Proganoscus was blinking and winking at her. She thought she saw the oval mandala eye through which she had come, but she was not sure. The cherubim raised a great wing to sketch the slow curve of sky above them. The warm rose and lavender of sunset faded, dimmed, was extinguished. The sky was drenched with green at the horizon, muting upwards into a deep purpley blue through which stars began to appear in totally unfamiliar constellations. Meg asked, "Where are we?" "Never mind where. Watch." She stood beside him, looking at the brilliance of the stars. Then came a sound which was above sound, beyond sound, a violent, silent, electrical report which made her press her hands in pain against her ears. Across the sky, where the stars were clustered as thickly as in the Milky Way, a crack shivered, slivered, became a line of nothingness. If this kind of thing was happening in the universe, no matter how far away from Earth and the Milky Way, Meg did not wonder that her father had been summoned to Washington and Brookhaven. "Progo, what is it? What happened?"
"The Ekthroi have exed."
"What?"
"Annihilated, negated, extinguished, exed."
Meg stared in horrible fascination at the rent in the sky. This was the most terrible thing she had ever seen, more horrifying than the Mr. Jenkins Ekthros the night before. She pressed close to the cherubim, surrounding herself with wings and eyes and puffs of smoke, but she could still see the rip in the sky. She could not bear it. She closed her eyes to shut it out. She tried to think of the most comfortable thing possible, the safest, most reasonable, ordinary thing. What, then? The dinner table at home. Winter. The red curtains drawn across the windows, and a quiet snow falling softly outdoors, an applewood fire in the fireplace, Aunt Fortinbras snoring happily on the hearth, a tape playing Holst's The Planets. No, maybe that wasn't too comforting. In her mind's ear, she shifted to a ghastly recording of the school band, with Sandy and Dennis playing somewhere in the cacophony. Dinner was over, and she was clearing the table and starting the dishes and only half listening to the conversation of her parents who were lingering over their coffee. It was almost as tangible as though she were actually there, and she thought she felt Progonoscus pushing at her mind, helping her remember. Had she really listened that attentively to her parents while she stood running hot water over the plates? Their voices were as clear as though she were actually in the room. Her father must have mentioned the terrible thing which Progonoscus had just shown her, the terrible thing which was terrible precisely because it was not a thing, because it was nothing. She could hear, too clearly, her father's voice, calm and rational, speaking to her mother. "It isn't just in distant galaxies that strange, unreasonable things are happening. Unreason has crept up on us so insidiously that we've hardly been aware of it. But think of the things going on in our own country which you wouldn't have believed possible only a few years ago." Mrs. Murray swirled the dregs of her coffee. "I don't think I believe all of them now, although I know they're happening." She looked up to see that the twins and Charles Wallace were out of the room, that Meg was splashing water in the sink as she scoured a pot. 10 years ago, we didn't even have a key to this house. Now we lock up when we go out. The irrational violence is even worse in the cities." Mr. Murray absent-mindedly began working out an equation on the tablecloth. For once, Mrs. Murray did not even seem to notice. He said, "They've never known a time when people drank rainwater because it was pure, or could eat snow or swim in any river or brook. The last time I drove home from Washington, the traffic was so bad I could have made better time with a horse. There were huge signs proclaiming speed limit 65 miles per hour, and we were crawling along at 20. And the children and I kept dinner hot for you for 3 hours, and finally ate, pretending we weren't worried that you might have been in an accident," Mrs. Murray said bitterly. "Here we are at the height of civilization in a well-run state in a great democracy, and 4 10-year-olds were picked up last week for pushing hard drugs in the school where our 6-year-old is regularly given black eyes and a bloody nose." She suddenly noticed the equation growing on the tablecloth. "What are you doing?" I have a hunch there's some connection between your discoveries about the effects of ferrandoli on mitochondria and that unexplained phenomenon out in space. His pencil added a fraction, some Greek characters, and squared them. Mrs. Murray said in a low voice, "My discoveries are not very pleasant."
"I know."
"I isolated ferrandoli because something beyond increasing air pollution has to account for the accelerating number of deaths from respiratory failure and this so-called flu epidemic. It was the micro-sonar scope which gave me the first clue." She stopped abruptly, looked at her husband. "It's the same sound, isn't it? The strange cry of the ailing mitochondria and the cry picked up in those distant galaxies by the new paraboloidoscope. There's a horrid similarity between them. I don't like it. I don't like the fact that we don't even see what's going on in our own backyard. L.A. is trying as honorably as a president can in a world which has become so blunted by dishonor and violence that people casually take it for granted. We have to see a great, dramatic fissure in the sky before we begin to take danger seriously. And I have to be deathly worried about our youngest child before I regard ferrandoli, except in a cool and academic manner." Meg had turned from the kitchen sink at the pain in her mother's voice and had seen her father reach across the table for her mother's hand. "My dear, this is not like you. With my intellect, I see cause for nothing but pessimism and even despair. But I can't settle for what my intellect tells me. That's not all of it." "What else is there?" Mrs. Murray's voice was low and anguished. "There are still stars which move in ordered and beautiful rhythm. There are still people in this world who keep promises. Even little ones, like your cooking stew over your Bunsen burner. You may be in the middle of an experiment, but you still remember to feed your family. That's enough to keep my heart optimistic, no matter how pessimistic my mind. And you and I have good enough minds to know how very limited and finite they really are. The naked intellect is an extraordinarily inaccurate instrument." Progonoscus said, "He's a wise man, your father." Could you hear me remembering? I was remembering with you. Most of that conversation you didn't hear with your conscious mind, you know. "I have a very good memory," Meg started. Then she stopped herself. "Okay, I know I couldn't have remembered all that by myself. I suppose I just sort of took in the sound waves, didn't I? But how did you get it all from me?" Progonoscus looked at her with two ringed owl-like eyes.
"You're beginning to learn how to kive."
"To what?"
"Kive.
It's how cherubim talk. It's talking without words, just the same way that I can be myself and not be enfleshed. But I have to be enfleshed, and I need words."
"I know, Meg," he replied gently, "and I will keep things worded for you.
But it will help if you will remember that cherubim kithe without words among each other. For a human creature, you show a distinct talent for kithing." She blushed slightly at the compliment. She had a feeling that paying compliments is a habit not often indulged in by cherubim. "Progo, I wish I'd been able to see the equation Father was doodling on the tablecloth. If I'd seen it, then it might be somewhere in my mind for you to pull out."
"Think," Progonoscus said. "I'll help."
Mother put the tablecloth in the wash.
"But you remember there were some Greek letters?"
"Yes."
"Let me try to find them with you."
She closed her eyes.
"That's right. Relax now.
Maybe this is the way for us to kithe.
Don't you try to think. Just let me move about."
Out of the corner of her mind's eye, she seemed to see three Greek characters among the numbers in the loosely strung equation her father was scribbling on the cloth. She thought them at Progonoscus. "Epsilon chi and theta. That's ekth," the cherubim told her. "Ekthroi? But how could father—" "Think of the conversation we just recalled, Meg. Your parents are very aware of the evil in the world." "All right. Yes, I know. Okay." Meg sounded cross. "Until Charles started school, I hoped maybe we could ignore it, like ostriches or something." The cherubim withdrew its wings from her entirely, leaving her exposed and cold on the strange hilltop. "Open your eyes and look where the sky's torn." "I'd rather not."
"Go on. I've got all my eyes open. You only have to open two."
Meg opened her eyes. The rent in the sky was still there. She wondered what this distant phenomenon could have to do with Charles Wallace's pallor, with mitochondritis or whatever it was. How, oh, Progo, how did the Ekthroid do that?
Like Charles Wallace, he picked up her particular anxiety. It has to do with unnaming. If we are namers, the Ekthroi are unnamers, non-namers.
Progo, what does that have to do with Mr. Jenkins?
She felt a wave of apprehension roll through her. Littling, I think that is what we must find out. I think that it is part of our first ordeal. Let us go.
He drew her back into himself again. Again she was confronted with the single eye, was pulled through the opening oval pupil. Then the pupil snapped shut, and they were together on the star-watching rock with dawn slowly lightening the east. Progo spread his wings wide, and she moved out.
What do we do now? He said.
The cherubim was asking her? I'm only a human being, not quite full-grown, she replied. How would I know?
Megling, I've never been on your planet before. This is your home. Charles Wallace is your brother. You are the one who knows Mr. Jenkins. You must tell me what we are to do now.
Meg stamped loudly and angrily against the hard, cold surface of the rock. This is too much responsibility. I'm still only a child. I didn't ask for any of this.
Are you refusing to take the test? Proganoscus pulled away from her.
But I didn't ask for it. I didn't ask for Blazhany or you or any of it.
Didn't you? I thought you were worried about Charles Wallace.
I am. I'm worried about everything.
Meg, Proganoscus was somber and stern. Are you going to enter into the ordeal? I must know. Now.
Meg stamped again. Of course I'm going to. You know I have to. Charles Wallace is in danger. I'll do anything to help him, even if it seems silly.
Then what do we do now?
She shoved at her glasses as though that would help her think. I'd better go home now and have breakfast. Then I'll get on my school bus. It stops at the bottom of the hill, and maybe you better wait for me there. Fortinbras might bark at you. I'm sure he'd know you were in the house, even if you dematerialize or whatever you call it.
Whatever you think best, Proganoscus said meekly.
I'll be down at the foot of the road at 7 o'clock. The high school bus covers so much distance and makes so many stops it takes an hour and a half, and I get on at one of the first stops. She felt an acquiescing response from the cherubim, and then he disappeared. She could not see even a shimmer or feel a flicker of him in her mind. She headed back to the house. She kept the flashlight on, not for the known turnings of the path, but for whatever new, unknown surprises might be waiting for her. When Meg got to the stone wall, Louise the Larger was there, waiting. Neither greeting nor attacking, waiting. Meg approached her cautiously. Louise watched her through eyes which shone in the flashlight like the water of a very deep well.
May I go by, please, Louise? Meg asked timidly.
Louise uncoiled, waving slightly in greeting, still looking intently at Meg. Then she bowed her head and slithered off into the rocks. Meg felt that Louise had been waiting for her to give her a warning for whatever lay ahead, and to wish her well. It was strangely comforting to know that Louise's well-wishing was going with her. There was sausage as well as hot porridge for breakfast. Meg felt that she ought to eat heartily because who knew what lay ahead, but she could manage only a few mouthfuls.
Are you all right, Meg? Her mother asked.
Fine, thanks.
You look a little pale. Sure you aren't coming down with something?
She's worried about all of us with this mitochondritis stuff. Just the normal throes of adolescence, she smiled at her mother.
Sandy said, If you don't want your sausage, I'll eat it. Dennis said, Half for me, okay?
Charles Wallace slowly and deliberately ate a full bowl of porridge, but gave the twins his sausage. Well then, Meg washed her dishes and put them in the rack. I'm off. Wait for us, Sandy said. She did not want to wait for the twins, to listen to their chatter on the walk down to the bus. On the other hand, it would keep her from thinking about what lay ahead. She had thought of Mr. Jenkins for as far back as she could remember with distaste, annoyance, and occasionally outrage, but never before with fear. When she left the house, she had a horrid, premonitory feeling that it would be a long time before she returned.
Again she wished that Fortinbras were walking to the bus with them, as he often did, and then returning to make the walk again with Charles Wallace. But this morning he showed no inclination to leave the warmth of the kitchen. "What do you suppose will happen today?" Sandy asked as they started down the hill in the chill of early morning. Dennis shrugged. "Nothing, as usual. Race you to the foot of the hill." Chapter 5. The First Test. Meg and the cherubim reached the deserted schoolyard in safety. "We've got a while to wait," Meg told him. "And it's okay for you, you're invisible, but I've got to find a place to hide." She could not see Progonoscus, but she talked at the faint shimmer in the air where she knew he was. "You're too late," the cherubim said, and Meg swung around to see Mr. Jenkins coming across the schoolyard from the faculty parking lot. Mr. Jenkins. The ordinary, everyday, usual Mr. Jenkins. There was no snake hissing and clacking at him, and he himself did nothing but continue his way across the schoolyard. He looked just as he always looked. He wore his usual dark business suit, and no matter how often it was brushed, there was always a small snowfall of dandruff on his shoulders. His salt-and-pepper hair was cut short, and his eyes were muddy behind his bifocals. He was neither short nor tall, fat nor thin, and whenever Meg saw him, her feet seemed to grow larger and she couldn't find a resting place for her hands. "All right, Margaret, what is this? What are you doing here?" He had every right to sound annoyed. She had nothing to reply. She felt Progonoscus close to her, felt his mind within hers, but he had nothing to suggest. "My dear child," Mr. Jenkins said, and his voice was unwontedly compassionate. "If you have come again about your little brother, I can now tell you that we are reviewing his case. It is not my policy of education to have one child intimidated by his peers, but our initial testing shows that Charles Wallace's talents are so unusual that unusual measures must be taken. I've had several consultations with the state board, and we are considering getting a special tutor for him." Meg looked warily at the principal. This sounded too good to be true, and Louise had been trying to warn her of something. Of what? The cherubim, too, was uneasy. She felt him moving lightly in her mind, feeling her response to this unexpectedly reasonable Mr. Jenkins. "That is nonsense," Mr. Jenkins said to Mr. Jenkins. "We cannot make an exception for any one child. Charles Wallace Murray must learn to manage." A second Mr. Jenkins was standing beside Mr. Jenkins. It was impossible. It was just as impossible as... But there were two identical dour Mr. Jenkinses standing in front of her. Progonoscus shimmered but did not materialize. Meg backed into the shimmer. She felt that the cherubim was opening an invisible wing and pulling her close to him. She could feel his tremendous, wild heartbeat, a frightened heartbeat, thundering in her ears. "We're namers," she heard through the racing of the heart. "We're namers. What is their name? Mr. Jenkins. No, no. This is the test, Meg. It must be. One of those Mr. Jenkinses is an ekthros. We have to know which is the real Mr. Jenkins." Meg looked at the two men who stood glaring at each other. "Progo, you can feel into me. Can't you feel into them? Can't you kithe?" "Not when I don't know who they are. You're the one who knows the prototype." "The what?" "The real one. The only Mr. Jenkins who is Mr. Jenkins. Look." Suddenly, beside the two Mr. Jenkinses stood a third Mr. Jenkins. He raised one hand in greeting, not to Meg, but to the other two men as he drew level with them. "Leave the poor girl alone for a few minutes," Mr. Jenkins 3 said. The three men wheeled, stiffly like marionettes, and walked across the schoolyard and into the building. "We must think, we must think." Progonoscus's kithe almost became opaque for a second, and Meg felt that he was restraining himself from spouting fire. Meg said, "Progo, if you really are a cherubim..." There was a great and surging invisible wave of indignation all around her. She hit the clenched fist of one hand against the palm of the other. "Wait, you told me to think and I'm thinking. You don't have to think out loud. You don't have to talk to think after all. You're deafening me. Try to kithe with me, Meg." "I still don't understand kithing. Is it like mental telepathy?" Progonoscus hesitated. You might say that mental telepathy is the very beginning of learning to kithe, but the cherubic language is entirely kithing. With you, with stars, with galaxies, with the salt in the ocean, the leaves of the trees. But I'm not a cherubim. How do I do it? Meg, your brain stores all the sensory impressions it receives, but your conscious mind doesn't have a key to the storehouse. All I want you to do is to open yourself up to me so that I can open the door to your mind's storehouse. All right? I'll try. To open herself entirely to the cherubim, to make herself completely vulnerable, was not going to be easy. But she trusted Progonoscus implicitly. Listen, she said. Cherubim have come to my planet before.
I know that. Where do you think I got my information?
What do you know about us?
I've heard that your host planet is shadowed, that it is troubled.
It's beautiful, Meg said defensively. She felt a rippling of his wings.
In the middle of your cities?
Well, no, but I don't live in a city.
And is your planet peaceful?
Well, no, it isn't very peaceful. I had the idea, Progonoscus moved reluctantly within her mind, that there are wars on your planet, people fighting and killing each other.
Yes, that's so, but...
And children go hungry,
yes.
And people don't understand each other.
Not always.
And there's hate?
Yes.
She felt Progonoscus pulling away.
All I want to do, he was murmuring to himself, is go someplace quiet and recite the names of the stars.
Progo, you said we were namers. I still don't know. What is a namer?
I've told you. A namer has to know who people are and who they are meant to be.
I don't know why I should have been shocked at finding Ekthroi on your planet.
Why are they here?
Ekthroi are always about when there's war. They start all war. Progo, I saw that awfulness you took me to see, that tearing of the sky and all, but you still haven't told me exactly what Ekthroi are.
Progonoscus probed into her mind, searching for words she could understand.
I think your mythology would call them fallen angels. War and hate are their business, and one of their chief weapons is unnaming, making people not know who they are. If someone knows who he is, really knows, then he doesn't need to hate. That's why we still need namers, because there are places throughout the universe like your planet Earth. When everyone is really and truly named, then the Ekthroi will be vanquished.
But what, oh Earthling, Earthling, why do you think Blagini called for you?
There is war in heaven, and we need all the help we can get. The Ekthroi are spreading through the universe. Every time a star goes out, another Ekthros has won a battle. A star, or a child, or a farandula. Size doesn't matter, Meg. The Ekthroi are after Charles Wallace, and the balance of the entire universe can be altered by the outcome.
But Progo, what does this have to do with our test, with the three Mr. Jenkinses? It's insane.
Progonoscus responded coldly and quietly. Precisely. Into the cold and quiet came the sound of the school buses arriving, doors opening, children rushing out and into the school building. Charles Wallace was one of those children. Progonoscus moved quietly in her mind through the roar. Don't misunderstand me, Meg. It is the ways of the Ekthroi which are insane. The ways of the teachers are often strange, but they are never haphazard. I know that Mr. Jenkins has to have something to do with it, something important, or we wouldn't be here.
Meg said unhappily,
If I hate Mr. Jenkins whenever I think of him, am I naming him?
Progonoscus shifted his wings. You're Xing him just like the Ekthroi.
Progo!
Meg, when people don't know who they are open either to being X'd or named.
And you think I'm supposed to name Mr. Jenkins?
It was a ridiculous idea. No matter how many Mr. Jenkinses there were, he was Mr. Jenkins. That's all.
But Progonoscus was most definite.
Yes.
Meg cried rebelliously. Well, I think it's a silly kind of test.
What you think is not the point. What you do is what's going to count.
How can it possibly help Charles?
I don't know. We don't have to know everything at once. We just do one thing at a time as it is given us to do. But how do I do it? How do I name Mr. Jenkins when all I think of when I see him is how awful he is?
Proganoscus sighed and flung several wings heavenwards so violently that he lifted several feet, materialized, and came down with a thud.
There's a word, but if I say it, you'll just misunderstand.
You have to say it.
It's a four-letter word. Aren't four-letter words considered the bad ones on your planet?
Come on. I've seen all the four-letter words on the walls of the washroom at school. Proganoscus let out a small puff.
Luff.
What?
Love. That's what makes persons know who they are. You're full of love, Meg, but you don't know how to stay within it when it's not easy.
What do you mean?
Oh, you love your family. That's easy. Sometimes when you feel awful about somebody, you get back into rightness by thinking about... Well, you seem to be telling me that you got back into love once by thinking about Charles Wallace.
Yes.
But this time it can't be easy. You have to go on to the next step.
If you mean you think I have to love Mr. Jenkins, you've got another think coming, Meg snapped.
Proganoscus gave a mighty sigh. If we pass the test, you'll go on and be taught, oh, some of the things I was taught my first millennium with the teachers. I had to pass a galaxy of tests before I could qualify as a star namer. But you're a human being, and it's all quite different with you. I keep forgetting that. Am I lovable? To you?
All about Meg, eyes opened and shut, wings shifted, a small flame burned her hand and was rapidly withdrawn. She coughed and then sucked the burned place on her hand.
But all she wanted was to put her arms around Proganoscus as she would around Charles Wallace.
Very lovable, she said.
But you don't love me the way you love that skinny Calvin?
That's different.
I thought so. That's the confusing kind, not the kind you have to have in order to name Mr. Jenkins.
I hate Mr. Jenkins.
Meg, it's the test. You have to name the real Mr. Jenkins, and I have to help you. If you fail, I fail too.
Then what would happen?
It's your first time with a teacher, and it would be your last.
And you?
When one has been with the teachers as often as I have, one is given a choice. I could throw in my lot with the Ekthroi.
What?
Quite a few of those who fail do.
But the Ekthroi are...
You know what they are. Sky terrors, light snuffers, planet darkeners, the dragons, the worms, those who hate.
Progo, you couldn't.
I hope I couldn't, but others have. It's not an easy choice.
If you don't go to the Ekthroi...
All Proganoscus's eyes were shielded by his wings. I am a namer. The Ekthroi would unname. If I do not go with them, then I must X myself.
What?
I'll ask you a riddle. What do you have the more of, the more of it you give away?
Oh, love, I suppose.
So, if I care more about naming than anything else, then maybe I have to give myself away. If it's the only way to show my love, all the way away, to X myself.
If you do it, X yourself, does it last forever? Meg asked apprehensively.
Nobody knows. Nobody will know till the end of time.
Do I have that choice too if we fail?
She turned away from the school building towards the early morning shouts and whistles and pressed her face against the soft feathers of one great pinion. It is not an option given to mortals, Earthling.
All that happens to me is that I go home?
If you can call it all. There would be rejoicing in hell. But perhaps you don't believe in hell?
Meg pushed this aside.
But if we fail, then you...
I must choose.
It's better to X myself than to be X'd by the Ekthroi.
What you took me to see... It was what Mother talked about at the dinner table, what Father's gone to Brookhaven about. It doesn't seem to have much to do with Mr. Jenkins. It's all so cosmic, so big.
It isn't size that matters, Meg. Right now it's Charles Wallace. The Ekthroi would annihilate Charles Wallace.
A little boy!
You've said yourself that he's a special little boy.
He is, oh, he is.
She gave a startled jump as the first bell went off inside the school building, strident, demanding. Progo, I don't understand any of it, but if you think naming Mr. Jenkins is going to help Charles Wallace, I'll do my best. You will help me?
I'll try. But Progonoscus did not sound confident. From all around them came the usual school day din. Then the door to the cafeteria gym opened and a Mr. Jenkins came out.
Which Mr. Jenkins? There was no telling them apart.
Meg looked to the cherubim, but he had dematerialized again, leaving only a shimmer to show where he was. Mr. Jenkins came to her. She checked his shoulders. There was the dandruff. She went closer, smelled. Yes, he had the Mr. Jenkins smell of old hair cream and what she always thought of as rancid deodorant. But all three of the Mr. Jenkinses could manage that much, she was sure. It was not going to be that easy. He looked at her coldly in the usual way, down one side of his slightly crooked nose.
I assume that you are as confused by all this as I am, Margaret. Why two strange men should wish to impersonate me, I have no idea. It is most inconvenient, just at the beginning of school when I am already overworked. I am told that it has something to do with you as well as your unfortunate little brother. I had hoped that this year you, at least, would not be one of my problems. It seems to me I have had to spend more time with you than with any other student in the school. It is certainly my misfortune. And now not only do I have to cope with your little brother, who is equally difficult, but here you are again. This was Mr. Jenkins. He had played upon the theme of this speech with infinite variations almost every time she was sent to his office. For some reason obscure to me, you are supposed to choose between the impostors and me. It is certainly in my interest to have you pass this absurd test. Then perhaps I can keep you out of my school.
And then, said Mr. Jenkins, two, appearing beside Mr. Jenkins, one, I will have time to concentrate on present problems instead of those which ought to be past. Now, Meg, if you will just for once in your life do it my way, not yours, I understand you're basically quite bright in mathematics. If you would simply stop approaching each problem in your life as though you were Einstein and had to solve the problems of the universe and would deign to follow one or two basic rules, you and I would have a great deal less trouble. This, too, was authentic Jenkins. The shimmer of the cherubim wavered uneasily.
Meg, Mr. Jenkins, too, said, I urge you to resolve this nonsense and tell the impostors that I am Mr. Jenkins. This whole farce is wasting a great deal of time. I am Mr. Jenkins, as you have cause to know.
She felt Progonoscus probing wildly.
Meg, when have you been most you? The very most you?
She closed her eyes. She remembered the first afternoon Calvin had come to the Murrays. Calvin was an honor student, but he was far better with words than with numbers, and Meg had helped him with a trigonometry problem. Since trig was not taught in Meg's grade, her easy competence was one of her first surprises for Calvin. But at the time she had not thought of surprising him. She had concentrated wholly on Calvin, on what he was doing, and she had felt wholly alive and herself.
How is that going to help? She asked the cherubim.
Think. You didn't know Calvin very well then, did you?
No, but you loved him, didn't you?
Then? I wasn't thinking about love, I was just thinking about trig.
Well then, Progonoscus said, as though that explained the entire nature of love.
But I can't think about trig with Mr. Jenkins, and I can't love him.
You love me.
But Progo, you're so awful you're lovable.
So is he, and you have to name him.
The third Mr. Jenkins joined the other two.
Meg, stop panicking and listen to me.
The three men stood side by side, identical, gray, dour, unperceptive, overworked, unlovable.
Meg, Mr. Jenkins too said, if you will name me, and quickly, I will see to it that Charles Wallace gets into competent medical hands immediately.
It's hardly that easy, Mr. Jenkins III said. After all, her parents do not know how to handle the situation, nor do they understand how serious it is, Mr. Jenkins II snapped. Mr. Jenkins III waved this aside.
Meg, does it not seem extraordinary to you that you should be confronted with three of me?
There seemed to be no answer to this question. Mr. Jenkins I shrugged in annoyance. Mr. Jenkins II said,
it is imperative that we stick to essentials at this point.